Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
In this lecture, attorney James Hamilton, Yale Law School class of 1963, discusses Vince Foster and the attorney-client privilege.
Harold wanted me to start off by saying how I got to Yale Law School. I think to affirm the proposition that he tells all graduates that if you were applying today, you'd never get in. And that's probably true. I grew up in Chester, South Carolina. It was a town of 7,000 when I was born, 7,000 when I left. It's still 7,000. Different 7,000, but you get the point. I went to Davidson College, which actually is a very fine school. I was not a top student at Davidson. I think they let me in at Yale because of diversity principles. They wanted something. They wanted a Southerner. They were actually two Southerners in my class. The other one was Marion Wright Edelman. Two South Carolinians in my class. The other was Marion Wright Edelman. And I'm not sure which of us was more intimidated by Yale Law School. It's hard to believe Marion, given what she's accomplished. She's the head of the Children's Defense Fund, for those of you who don't know. Hard to believe that she could be intimidated by anybody, but she was when she first arrived at Yale Law School. I can remember my first year, I went to moot court, and the woman arguing in the finals of the moot court in my class was Barbara Babcock Bowen, who now teaches at Stanford, who'd been the national debating champion. And I can remember listening to her argue and decided I was in the wrong profession. But anyway, I have survived. And I guess my practice sort of took a direction after I started off at Covington, because I went on the Senate Watergate Committee. I worked for Senator Sam Ervin, had the good fortune of being in charge of the investigation of the breaking and the cover-up, and that sort of shaped my career since. I want to talk today about this case that I had that established that the attorney-client privilege survives death. It's a case that attracted a lot of attention. It's obviously in your case books now, but back then when it came down, it attracted a lot of attention for, I think, several reasons. First of all, we all die. And secondly, a lot of people, particularly people in Washington, have the need for lawyers. So there was a lot of interest, a lot of press interest. I remember the day the decision came down, but before it came down, I got a call from ABC News. Then the morning show was run by Cokie Roberts and Sam Donaldson. And the producer called me and she said, Mr. Hamilton, we would like for you to appear on the Sunday morning talk show with Sam and Cokie if you lose. I'm glad somebody smiled about that, because I told that story once to about a group of 50 reporters and nobody cracked a smile. They thought it was business as usual. There were a number of cartoons that came out of this this case. And my favorite one was from the Dayton Daily News and Tribune. Two men in the cartoon, one sitting on one side of a desk, the client, and the other one sitting on the other side of the desk, who was a lawyer. And the client said to the lawyer, what can I do to assure that this conversation is privileged? And the lawyer said, marry me. My favorite article was in the Davis Alumni Journal. You know, sometimes alumni journals are not too well edited. And this article started off by saying there was a Supreme Court case, Swidler in Berlin versus United States, involved a conversation that Mr. Hamilton had with Deputy White House Counsel Vince Foster 9 days after he died. My firm decided I should advertise I had a new specialty. Let me tell you a little bit about Vince Foster. I got to know Vince in 1993. As Harold said, I was in charge of vetting the Clinton cabinet and White House staff. And after he came in to office, I did not go into the government because I had three children to educate. But I was asked to vet the Supreme Court candidates. And I did that with Vince Foster. We vetted Steve Breyer, we vetted Ruth Ginsburg, we vetted some other people. Looking back at it, I feel somewhat like a dolt, because I didn't realize that Vince was seeping deeper and deeper into the depression that eventually took his life. But Vince really was a splendid fella. He was tall, he was handsome as a movie star, he was well educated. In fact, he had gone to Davidson College, so he had a natural affinity. He was first in his class in Arkansas Law School. At the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock, he was Hillary Clinton's best friend. He would have been the president of the Arkansas Bar had he stayed in Arkansas, but he came to Washington. And Washington was the wrong place for Vince Foster. He hated the press scrutiny and he hated the criticism that he got. His famous note that was found torn up in his briefcase shortly after he died said that he was not meant for the spotlight of public life in Washington. And of course, his illness made his discomfort all the worse. Vince had been in Washington only a few months, Clinton administration had been in only a few months, when the travel office matter broke, known as Travelgate. Now, this really wasn't a major matter, but it was the sort of the first Clinton scandal, and it involved the firing of the travel office staff, the staff that made the arrangements for the press corps and all of that, allegedly to favor Clinton cronies. And one of the problems was that the existing travel office staff had been investigated by the FBI, and that was considered, at least by some, to be a misuse of the FBI. So the press was on the scent of this first Clinton scandal. Congressional investigations were likely. Bob Dole, who was the majority leader, called for an independent investigation. The White House had done its own investigation into this, but that didn't abort the criticism. And this, so it was a real Washington happening, like we can only have in Washington when a scandal breaks. On July 11th, 1993, at 10 a.m. in the morning, a Sunday morning, Vince Foster visited me at my home about representing the White House and perhaps him in the travel office matter. We talked about the White House's needs and his needs for 2 hours. And during that 2 hours, I took 3 pages of notes on long yellow paper in my sort of ungainly, rather large handwriting. The first question that Vince put to me when he sat down in my living room was, is this conversation privileged? And I said, yes. And about the first words in my 3 pages of notes is the word privileged. 9 days later, Vince Foster took his own life in Fort Marcy Park in Northern Virginia. And later that night, I was called by the White House counsel, Bernie Nussbaum, and then later by Webb Hubble, who was the Associate Attorney General, and asked to represent the family. And thinking that this would be a short-lived representation, I said, sure. Representation ended 11 years later, after I'd argued 2 cases in the Supreme Court regarding the Foster death. I must say I have great fondness and admiration for the family. You know, so many people in this day and age, when there's some trauma in the family, they go on Oprah, they go on Jerry Springer, they lay out their innermost thoughts to the world. The Foster family did none of this, none of this. There was not a single television appearance. Lisa Foster, his Vince's widow, gave one interview to the New Yorker magazine, sort of as catharsis, right before she remarried to James Moody, who's a district judge, federal district judge in Little Rock. But after the death, multiple investigations ensued. Eventually, the investigation by Ken Starr, who was the second independent counsel. I was interviewed by Starr's staff, and when asked, I told them that I had had this meeting with Vince, and then I'd taken some notes. And they said, let us have the notes. And I said, no, you can't have them. They're privileged. So on December 4, 1995, which by the way was my birthday, subpoenas came to me and my firm, Swidler Berlin, from a grand jury that Starr had convened. Now this subpoena sought not only my notes of my conversation with Vince, it sought hundreds of pages of documents that I had accumulated representing the family. And this representation included ongoing matters, including a grand jury investigation that was then underway. I mean, basically what Starr wanted me to do was to be his eyes and ears in the White House, and I declined the honor. And the attempt to get the notes particularly irked me because it offended basic notions that I had of the sanctity of the attorney-client privilege. Now, obviously, I'm not going to tell you what's in these notes that I fought for a number of years to protect. I will tell you, though, that there's nothing earth-shattering in them. This battle was largely a matter of principle. I thought that if to give these notes away would have had huge adverse ramifications, both for the profession and for clients. So my firm and I moved to quash the subpoenas on attorney-client and work product grounds. And in the district court before Judge Penn, we won everything. Showing at least some good sense, Starr decided to appeal only the Foster notes issue. And in the Court of Appeals, he had a bright line argument. He argued that the attorney-client privilege and the work product privilege vanish after the client dies, at least in criminal proceedings. The argument in the Court of Appeals that I had was against another Yale graduate, Brett Kavanaugh. Now, Brett has been in the news lately. He has just been put on the D.C. Circuit after a protracted nomination fight. He is now, I think, the ripe old age of 41, maybe he's turned 42. Very bright guy, a Kennedy clerk. After the argument, one of my partners.
He'll be sworn in tomorrow or invested tomorrow.
He's already been sitting. After the argument to the Court of Appeals, one of my partners who had attended the argument said, Jim, you know, you gave a pretty good argument, but your 12-year-old daughter could win this case. And then I lost it. I lost it 2-1 in the Court of Appeals, which either shows that Brett is a very good lawyer or I should have brought in my daughter.
Who was the panel?
The panel was Steve Williams, Pat Wall, and David Tatel, who dissented. But the court's grounds, and the opinion was written by Williams, the court's grounds were different than what Starr had argued. As to the attorney-client privilege, the court set up a balancing test, which greatly favored the prosecutor. Basically says that the prosecutor gets the evidence if the evidence is not available elsewhere and the prosecutor really shows some need for it. Now, the court's reason to conclude that the privilege is not absolute after death, like it is before death, was that the client doesn't care much about his or her reputation after he or she dies, and doesn't care about the fate of friends or family in criminal proceedings after death. And consequently, there's no chilling effect on client candor even if the client knows that there can be disclosure after death. Now, I submit to you that this is just contrary to human experience. And it was particularly wrong as to Vince Foster, who cared deeply, deeply about his own reputation and about the fate of his family and friends, including Hillary Clinton. In May of 1993, he'd given a commencement speech to the University of Arkansas Law School. And I commend that to all of you. Because in that commencement speech, he said, there's no victory no advantage, no fee, no favor that is worth the damage to your reputation. And if you remember his note that I mentioned a minute ago, he said with obvious reference to himself that in Washington, ruining people is considered sport. And both the Fisk report, Bob Fisk was the first independent counsel, and then Ken Starr's report made a finding that his concern about his reputation deepened the depression that he was seeking into. But the court's work product ruling was even more bizarre. The court ruled that the relaxed standard for ordinary work product applied, which means the prosecutor wins if there's substantial need and he's unable to get the information without substantial hardship. That standard applied rather than the more stringent standard that is usually applied for opinion or core work product, which basically is that that a prosecutor will get this only if extraordinary need. In some jurisdictions, you never can get opinion work product. In the District of Columbia, it's very hard to get it. Now, the reason Williams said for applying the relaxed standard is that in the initial client interview, which is what he said I had, the lawyer is just a passive scribe in taking notes. The lawyer doesn't exercise his or her professional judgment by focusing the conversation or weeding out information before writing something down. Now, I suspect few litigators in America would agree with that wildly, wildly uninformed conclusion.
Williams never
practiced law. Williams, you got my next line. Williams was an academic. He had never practiced law. Now, why Yale grad Pat Wall, whom I have great respect for, went along with this opinion is mystifying to me. But this conclusion was particularly contrary to the facts here, because as I told you, in 2 hours of talking to Vince Foster, I had taken just 3 pages of notes because I knew a lot about the travel office before he walked in the door. It had been in the press for weeks. The White House had put out a fairly thick report, which I had read and made copious notes on. So I knew before he walked in what this was about, and I made notes about the things that interested me, about questions I wanted to ask, about follow-up steps I wanted to take. I was anything but a passive scribe. Now, Dave Tatel, who dissented, had been a practicing lawyer, and he wrote 2 dissents, one on the merits, and secondly, when the Court of Appeals refused to give us rehearing in bank. And he ridiculed the court's position on both the attorney-client and the work product issues. Well, in any event, after losing the petition for rehearing, we sought cert. And we did it with a lot of help. I figured that the court needed to know that this was an important issue. So we got amicus briefs from the American Bar Association, from the American Corporate Counsel Society, from the American College of Trial Lawyers, from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and we got an amicus brief from the National Hospice Association. Now, why did we do that? Why did we do that? Really, there were 2 reasons. One, having the hospice people in there supported our argument that the opinion of the Court of Appeals discriminated against the dying, discriminated against people who knew that they were on their last leg. And I'll give you an example I used at oral argument of a dying father who has a son on drugs who is having potential criminal issues. And he calls in his lawyer to talk about his son's problems. And then, but if he knows that when he passes away, that's fair game for a prosecutor, he's not going to do it. And in, by my lights, that's discriminating against somebody who is aged or who is diseased or who's distraught. And it's just not a fair place to leave the law. I do think, by the way, that Kennedy, before I gave that example, was going against me a little bit, and I think that helped to turn him around. Now, do I know that? No, because I'm not a psychologist, but I think there's a chance. Now, but there was another reason we wanted the hospice group's help. And I hope this doesn't shock you. But Justice Rehnquist, right before then, had lost his wife. His wife had been in a hospice situation. That make a difference? I don't know, but Rehnquist wrote the opinion for the majority. When the Supreme Court took this case, Starr returned to his bright line test. Remember, the Court of Appeals had used a balancing test. Starr returned to his bright line test. The privilege goes away when the client dies. Now, I'll tell you why he did it. It's really quite clear, because there are Supreme Court opinions that were flatly against the balancing test. I'm sure everybody in this room has read the Upjohn case, which the Supreme Court decided, 25, 30 years ago, which basically condemned the balancing test on the grounds that an uncertain privilege is little better than no privilege at all in encouraging client candor. Because if you're going to have an after-the-fact determination, some balancing as to whether this is privileged or not, any client who knows that's not going to talk to you. And I will tell you, I know that because I do a lot of white-collar work. It's hard enough to get some of these people to talk to you anyway, because they're telling you things that may be incriminating. Starr also, in the Supreme Court, in going for cert, did not try to defend this terribly misguided work product decision by Judge Williams. He basically argued that there should be no attorney-client or work product privilege after death, and he asked the court to reject the balancing test that the Court of Appeals had established. Now, the Supreme Court took cert, and I want to talk about two aspects of the proceedings before the court. And the first is this. As I just noted, Starr had attempted to amend the judgment of the Court of Appeals. Now, he can't do that unless he cross petitions for cert, which he didn't do. Now, Starr had been the Solicitor General of the United States, and he should have known that. I bet you Drew Dace knew that. But what he did is, in his briefs, he tried to amend the judgment. And we challenged this, citing a decision by Ruth Ginsburg about 3 or 4 years before that basically said, you can't do this. You can't seek to amend the judgment unless you cross petition. Now, why did we do this? All the Supreme Court clerks here at Yale Law School will tell you, if the Supreme Court wants to amend the judgment, it's going to amend the judgment. So why did we challenge him in this? The reason we did it was to distract Brett at oral argument, to have him deal with an issue at oral argument that he didn't want to deal with, and it worked. He got up and he started talking, and he got right into what he was doing, and Ruth Ginsburg jumped him, who had written the opinion that we had cited. And then Souter and O'Connor chimed in. And frankly, I have a great deal of admiration for Brett, but he could have done a better job digging out of this hole that he'd gotten himself in, and it took him 10 minutes to do it. 10 minutes he could have used more productively arguing the merits of the case. Now, the thorniest issue in this case was what to say about an issue that Starr had raised, which was the situation of a defendant in a capital murder case where a deceased client had admitted to his attorney that he had committed the crime, not the guy who was on trial, and where the defendant sought to break the privilege and to obtain the attorney's testimony. Now, Starr argued with some force that to apply the attorney-client privilege, an absolute privilege, in this circumstance could result in extreme unfairness to a criminal defendant. And indeed, there was a case where this had happened, a case called McCumber versus the state, that was decided by the Supreme Court of Arizona in 1976. This is exactly what had happened there. And Starr argued that, in this case, the defendant should have a constitutional right to break the privilege. And if a defendant has a constitutional right to break the privilege, then the grand jury ought to be able to break the privilege, because the grand jury also has a constitutional right, the constitutional right to investigate. So if one constitutional right outweighs the privilege, another constitutional right should outweigh the privilege. So our problem was this. Do we admit that there was an exception for the situation involving a criminal defendant? If we did that, we would be admitting that the attorney-client privilege was not absolute, and thus we would weaken our argument. So this was a real conundrum, and I will tell you that I spent hours talking with my cohort in this case, a very brilliant lawyer named Bob Zena, who's in my office, about what to do about this. Our decision, after much thought, was to admit the exception. We said that in rare cases, in a rare case, the constitutional rights of a defendant to a fair trial might outweigh the privilege. But we said, that's not the case here, and the court doesn't need to reach that issue. Here we're dealing with a prosecutor's request for evidence, and the law treats prosecutors and defendants differently. For example, under the Supreme Court's Brady case, a defendant is entitled to exculpatory information from the prosecutor, but a prosecutor is never entitled to incriminating testimony from the defendant. And if you look at Rule 16 of the Criminal Rules of Procedure, those rules give defendants and prosecutors different rights. Indeed, if you look at the rule carefully, defendants really have more discovery rights than prosecutors. Thus, we said there should be different rules, by analogy, as to breaching the attorney-client privilege for prosecutors and for defendants. Now, this concession and argument, I think, helped us win the case. When Brett tried to make this point in oral argument, Justice Stevens noted our concession and basically said to him, move on. Mr. Foster's lawyers conceded this. And the six-person majority in a footnote noted our concession and said there's no need to reach this issue here. Now, the three dissenting justices, Scalia, Thomas, and Sandra Day O'Connor, thought we'd given away the store, that by conceding the privilege was not absolute, we had agreed that it should be subject to balancing. But I think that this concession saved us from being stuck with a position that was just too rigid. That would have presented the possibility of unconstitutional harm to some defendant down the road.
Did you make the concession in your opening brief?
I made it in the opening brief. And I made it, didn't have to, I think we made it in both briefs. We certainly made it in the opening brief. The Supreme Court, of course, ruled that the privilege survived death in the circumstance before it, and that if it did not, the attorney-client communications would be unduly chilled. A contrary result, I think, which Starr should have seen, had he not been blinded by prosecutorial zeal and I believe a desire to get Hillary Clinton, contrary result would have been disastrous for the clients, it would have been disastrous for the profession, and I think it would have been disastrous for the rule of law, but I admit that I'm a little bit biased on this particular issue. Now, I'm going to close this by answering the question that I'm always asked when I make this presentation, which is why, given the fact that a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client, did I argue the case myself in the Supreme Court? And there were really four reasons. And the last reason I'm going to give you to make a point. The first reason was I really thought I could relay the facts of my conversation with Vince with more force and credibility than anyone else, without, frankly, any fear of contradiction, because nobody else was there except Vince, and he was no longer with us. Secondly, there was a cost factor. Third, the Foster family clearly wanted me to do this. And fourthly, and candidly, I wanted to do it. This was a big case. I like big cases. And those of you in the audience who are going to practice law, and I hope some of you will, should also look for the big cases because they're exciting. They give you a chance to utilize your natural talents and the skills you've learned at Yale. And often they present the best opportunity to do something important, to advance the laws and the law in useful ways, which we were taught at Yale we ought to do. Thank you.
James Hamilton delivered this lecture at Yale Law School on September 26, 2006.